frivolous lawsuits. They're happening more and more these days. We're talking about Christians and lawsuits. Next on The Balanced Word.
Wake up my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up my hand. And the instrument I play. Wake up my voice. Let the world hear me say, you are worshipped and exalted here today.
Every year, America's courtrooms are flooded with thousands of people suing each other. Some lawsuits are legitimate, while others are just plain absurd. It's getting to the point where people sue for just about anything. In light of this, where do Christians fit in? What does the Bible have to say about Christians being involved in lawsuits? We'll get a balanced biblical perspective on The Balanced Word today, as Pastor Dave Rolfe turns to 1 Corinthians chapter 6.
Well, let's turn in our Bibles now to 1 Corinthians chapter 6 as we continue this study through the book of 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 was all about sin in the body and how to deal with it. And Paul was explaining it wouldn't become a big deal if you dealt with it right from the beginning. And he continues on in that same vein here in chapter 6, talking about Christians suing each other, going to court with each other. It's just a natural outflowing of what happens when you don't deal with things when you should. They get bigger, and in the case of Corinth, they blew up in court. This is relevant to us in our society. It's such a litigious society. People sue over almost anything. Maybe you read about it in the newspaper or saw it on the internet. There was an attorney and a judge in Washington, D.C., named Roy Pearson, who took his pants to a dry cleaner that was run by a little family-owned operation. He took his pants in to get them dry cleaned, and he wasn't happy with the way his pants came out. But on their window there in the dry cleaner was a sign, a little hand-drawn sign that said, "Satisfaction Guaranteed." And he decided, this judge, Roy Pearson, decided that he wasn't satisfied and satisfaction was guaranteed. So he filed a lawsuit against the dry cleaner, for just $67 million. And this is somebody who works for the government to help make things fair in the courts. This is a judge. And more we're seeing this kind of stuff. There's an award called the Stella Award, named after the lady Stella who burned herself with coffee from McDonald's because she didn't know the coffee was hot and spilled it on herself and, you know, therefore won a big award. And so now every year they give the Stella Award to someone for ridiculous lawsuits. One of the winners was the guy who sued McDonald's, again, not for burning himself with coffee, but he was concerned because the Big Macs don't have a warning on there that if you eat them all the time, you'll get fat. And he had gotten fat and got diabetes, and he figured it must be McDonald's fault. Well, that's kind of the way things were going there in Corinth. The area of Corinth was really proud of having a well-developed system of justice. There were lawyers on every street corner and people who, every time they stumbled or fell, every time they were hurt, rather than take responsibility for it themselves, they decided it must be someone else's fault. They were dragging each other into court, and it was affecting the church. Because people who were going to church together on Sunday would be meeting in court on Monday, having their lawsuit in front of these judges who were ungodly people in the first place. When in verse 1, where they're called going to court before the unrighteous, the word there is the word for justice, and then with the negative put onto it. He was saying those people who are in the injustice system, that's who's trying to solve your problem. So it was big then, even as it is in our litigious society today. And let's look at what Paul said about it, beginning with verse 1. He says, "Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Do you not know that the saints will judge the world?" By saints, by the way, he's just referring to all Christians. "And if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? Do you not know that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? If then you have judgments concerning things pertaining to this life, do you appoint those who are least esteemed by the church to judge? I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you, not even one, who will be able to judge between his brothers? But brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. Now, therefore, it is already an utter failure for you that you go to law against one another. Why do you not rather accept wrong? Why do you not rather let yourselves be cheated? No, you yourselves do wrong and cheat, and you do these things to your brethren. Paul was letting them know the way the situation has developed, where you're suing each other, it's just really embarrassing. He doesn't ever say it's a sin, and he certainly doesn't say there's never a time for you to go to court. But he says, you ought to be ashamed of yourselves the way you're doing this, the way this is unfolding, the way you're handling your problems the way you are by rushing off into court. And he gives several different reasons why it's a bad idea, why it's so ridiculous, and why it's such a destructive thing to the church. And his first explanation, his first argument, is kind of a strange one in terms of putting it first. It's a little hard to even understand it, but it's in verses 2 and 3. He asks two questions, do you not know? Later in chapter 6, he'll ask some more questions that start out, do you not know? But he goes, do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? And then, do you not know that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? So he says, first of all, someday you're going to judge the world and you're going to judge angels. What does that mean? And it's not easy to discern because there aren't a lot of other verses that shed a whole lot of light on this in terms of in what way are we going to judge the world? I thought Jesus was going to judge the world. And certainly, and what are you talking about that we're going to judge angels? Now, judging angels is probably talking about the fallen angels, those who rebelled against God and rejected him and went off with Satan. And we certainly know that they are going to be judged someday as they will be cast into the lake of fire. We know the world who rejects Jesus Christ will one day have to answer for in a judgment at the judgment seat of Christ as to why they rejected him when Jesus died to save them from their sins. But what does that have to do with us? It's not easy to say, and commentators have tons of different theories on what this means. One thing that we do know is when Jesus comes back to judge the earth, we are coming with him. Over in the little book of Jude, it's the book right before Revelation, there's a passage about the demons being judged, but also there's an interesting few verses. Jude, beginning with verse 14, Jude's quoting a prophecy of Enoch, and he said, behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment on all, to convict all who are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds which they have committed in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. So when Jesus returns to establish his kingdom on the earth, he's going to bring his saints with him, that's us, and he's going to judge the earth. So we will be there somehow involved in that. Now, if you turn over to Revelation chapter 20, you get a little more of the picture. In Revelation 20, beginning with verse 4, John is describing the scene after the tribulation period, and there's a kingdom that Jesus establishes on the earth that we call the millennium. He says in verse 4, Revelation chapter 20, and I saw thrones, and they sat on them, they that sat on them, and judgment was committed to them, people sitting on thrones. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God. those who had been killed during the tribulation period, who had not worshiped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead didn't live again until 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. So we see from both of those passages, there's a time when as Jesus reigns on the earth, we're going to be reigning with him. And in some sense, we are involved in what he does as he establishes his kingdom. Now, what's exactly that going to be like and what will we be doing? Who knows? I don't. But we do know that we have a role to play when Jesus establishes his kingdom on the earth. Now, you think, what is there for us to do with him sitting on the throne? It's like, do what he tells you to do. But remember, in 1,000 years, a lot of people will be born in that many generations. So the people who populate the earth at the beginning of the millennium, which will probably be, for the most part, those people who hadn't reached an age of accountability yet during the tribulation period, perhaps those who, for whatever reason, refused to take the mark, but who weren't really Christians, they will be populating the earth. And in 1,000 years with very little death, all those generations, a lot's going to happen. So much so that by the end of the millennium, when Satan is released, a whole lot of people side with him and rebel against Jesus. So certainly during that time, during the millennial period, there are going to be people who need to be kept in line. Because flesh is still flesh. And just like in the Garden of Eden, the environment was perfect, and yet people tended to want to do what was wrong. So we are somehow connected with that, and we will be helping him in his judgment and ruling over the earth. We'll be sitting there when he judges the wicked, at least sitting there behind him, giving our assent to it. But also, in some ways, when the judgment comes, we might be used as evidence, exhibit A. Because when people come before God to be judged, and they come up with their excuses, all he has to do is point at us. Someone says, but wait a minute, Jesus, it's not fair. I wasn't smart enough to figure it out. And he goes, check out these people. Doesn't take smart. And they were in the same situation that you were in, and they turned their lives over to me. They were redeemed. They accepted the sacrifice. And so here we will somehow in the end be a testimony, even to those who are judged, of God's love and his faithfulness. And so with whatever role we have in the future, you go, what does this have to do with lawsuits? Well, here's the thing. Paul is saying, you have a glorious future. God has great things in store for you. Exaltation that he's going to pour out on you there in the future in his kingdom. And for you to be going before non-Christians trying to have them fix what's wrong with you, they're the ones that you're testifying to. They're the ones who ultimately will be seeing you and recognizing, ooh, you know, I could have that. I could be where they are. And he goes, you guys have such a great future. It's just incongruous. It's just inappropriate that you would be battling things out in court down here when you know the universe is going to be your inheritance someday. What are you squabbling over things down here for? And why are you being such a bad example to those people that you're here to be a witness to and a testimony to? Imagine if at the judgment, Jesus is addressing someone's rejection of him, and then you look and go, oh man, that was my lawyer. And he looks at me and goes, you? You made it? What? I mean, you never told me why. I thought you had me fix your mess. You had me get you out of your jam. And so it's that shame that ought to come from even being associated with something like that, that he's talking about. Kind of like when I remember when I was a kid, and you know, I grew up going to church all the time and really didn't know the Lord, but I went to church. I was a church going person. And I remember one time I had a friend in junior high that I would hang out with quite a bit, and he also went to church. But there's no way in the world that school that we would have ever told each other that we go to church, because we were two of the worst people in the school. And I remember the time when they came and visited our church, and Dan and I got into class, and we look at each other, and it's like we were both just completely shocked. Dan goes, "What are you doing here?" I go, "What are you doing here?" Well, that's kind of the idea. Like, you're going to be there and go, "What? This doesn't jive. This doesn't work." Now, once Dan and I got together at church, we were really dangerous. But in that day, Paul's going, you know, you're going in front of these people that you ought to be an example to. And it's just weird. It's just out of sync. Something's wrong and inappropriate about you using the methodology of the world. The same thing may be said for going to non-Christians to have them solve your problems for you. It's, you know, come on, isn't this something that could happen within the church? You're going to go to someone who doesn't even know God and ask them to fix you? And so his first reason why they should stay out of court with each other is you've got an exalted future. In a sense, he's saying, come on, you're better than that. You have a greater future than that. You don't need this so much. But secondly, as he goes on, he says also, what you're doing when you're going to court is you're destroying the family. You're destroying that closeness that you're supposed to have. As he says in verse 4, if then you have judgments concerning things pertaining to this life, do you appoint those who are least esteemed by the church to judge? I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you, not even one, who will be able to judge between his brethren? But brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. He said, when you get into these legal skirmishes, it's something that, hey, you're supposed to be family. As he goes through the rest of 1 Corinthians, he makes it clear, we are a family. We are a body. We need each other. When one member hurts, the other members hurt. You don't cut off a hand and have the rest of the body go, oh, I'm glad it's not me. The rest of the body hurts when a hand is removed because we all need each other. And so he's saying these kind of fights, these kinds of battles, these lawsuits, they're splitting up families. And there's got to be a way to deal with this within the family. There's nothing more horrible than for families to be split. There's probably no lawsuit that's more ugly than those lawsuits that are in family court, as families are ripped apart. And nowadays they say that as Christians, we get divorced about at the same rate as non-Christians do. I'm not sure if that's quite accurate. I suppose it is for people who call themselves Christians. And yet still, let's face it, we all know some people who are good Christians who just can't get along and end up getting a divorce. And what an awful and an ugly thing it is when that happens. The damage that's done, not just to the two of them, but to everyone connected with them. You know what happens when someone in your family is fighting with someone else in your family. And it ends up the whole family gets split and takes sides. Because you're either going to, well, you go, okay, we're going to have a family get together, but this person doesn't get along with that person. So they say, if he's coming, I'm not coming. And then it's like, oh, great. Who do we have? What do we do? How does this work? And everyone ends up picking sides. It's the same thing that happens sometimes at a wedding when you have kind of complicated family issues where there are people who, you know, parents of the bride or groom who've been divorced for quite a while, maybe been married several other times. And now here you have this idyllic picture of the bride and groom. They're coming together. We're celebrating marriage. And then instead of just having, you know, the father and mother of the bride and the father and mother of the groom, nowadays I'm almost surprised when that's all there is. Usually it's like, well, okay. And when you ask, who gives this woman in holy matrimony? It's like her mothers and our fathers and the rest of us step in. It's like, boy, what do you do? And who sits on what row of the, you know, it can just become such a mess because there's this tearing that happens. And, you know, here Paul is going, you guys are family. Isn't there a way to deal with your problems, to deal with these issues short of suing each other? So often in the church, this happens. Two people have a fight with each other. And for one thing, as he says, isn't there one person who can deal with this? Well, we tend to think, well, I need to let as many people as possible know what's going on. And so what happens is two people are banging heads. Next thing you know, everybody in the church knows about it from one perspective or another. And some are saying, well, I'm going to side with this one. Others, I'm going to side with that one. It becomes completely divisive and disruptive, and it tears us apart. It's one of those things where so often when there's a marital spat that's so bad, when a bunch of other people get involved, it affects the whole body. I mean, I have one of the best things that I think I ever tell people when they're having a marital dispute is you guys both deserve each other, because it's really true. Usually in most, and there are some cases, I've seen some cases where one of the spouses is just completely at fault and the other is just as pure as the driven snow. And that just means the pure one has a great sales pitch. But you know, there are times when it's uneven, but it doesn't matter whether it's uneven or not. What happens is everyone is affected. Everybody knows about it, and how do we deal with that? And ultimately, it deteriorates sometimes to the point where the courts get involved, and there are threats, and papers are filed, and all that kind of stuff. And it doesn't just affect those two. It obviously affects their kids. It affects in-laws. How would you feel? And I know some of you have probably been in this situation where you really love your spouse's family, but then you break up, and now it's like you can't be friends with them. It's awkward when you see them. Even when you have two friends who are dating and they break up, and then you see the one who's not your closest friend, and it's weird, you know. And Paul's going, you're family. And having this kind of litigious approach to life, having these battles and these lawsuits and everyone, the juries get involved and everything else, it doesn't fit. It's a shame. You should be embarrassed to do this. This is your family.
You're listening to Pastor Dave Rolfe on The Balanced Word and part of a study in 1 Corinthians. Hear it again online at thebalancedword.com. Or give us a call and request a CD at 949-362-7475. That's 949-362-7475. Pastor Dave has taught through the entire Bible, and we put it onto a USB for you. It's our featured resource right now, available for a donation of $30 or more. Request it right now at thebalancedword.com or call 949-362-7475. It takes a team to bring these shows to the radio every day, and your financial and prayerful support is really an investment, helping to reach thousands with the truth of God's Word. Thank you for standing with us with either a one-time gift or ongoing monthly support. Again, go to thebalancedword.com. Dave Rolfe is the pastor of Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel and loves to meet and greet his radio listeners. Visit us on a Sunday morning at 8, 9:45, or 11:30. Those outside the area can live stream at ccpacifichills.org. Would you like someone to pray for you? Send that prayer request over to us at thebalancedword.com by clicking on Contact or call 949-362-7475. Pastor Dave shares helpful and encouraging one-minute messages on Facebook and Instagram. Check it out at CC Pacific Hills. So is 1 Corinthians chapter 6 saying Christians can never go to court? Pastor Dave addresses that for a minute.
And I want to make this clear as we're looking here at 1 Corinthians 6. This isn't saying you can never have a lawsuit. It's not even saying I don't believe that you could never have a lawsuit in which Christians are involved in both sides, because there are certain things that may have to come to that if that which is at stake is so important. For instance, if one of you wants to go put a lien on my house and try to take my house away from me, if we can't work it out, we're probably going to court. I'm not going to let somebody come in and do something that's going to take our church away from us. Or, you know, there are all sorts of things that might be worth going to court over. But in general, what he's saying is, you're already saying we both lose by even going to court. So consider what you have to lose. And Paul would say, you know, there are a lot of times you'll wish you had just taken the loss. You'll wish you had just done whatever it would take to make this right.
Consider what you have to lose. Nobody really wins when you go to court. And with that, we'll leave you today. But we'll talk about this more tomorrow on The Balanced Word with Pastor Dave Rolfe, a presentation of Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel.
Wake up my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up my hands. And the instrument I play. Wake up.